Today is Wednesday, the December 6th, the year 2000. We're on the campus of University of Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana. I'm Jeff Charnley, along with Dr. Fred Honhart of Michigan State University, interviewing the Reverend Theodore Hesburgh, President Emeritus of Notre Dame. This interview is part of a series for the sesquicentennial commemoration at Michigan State coming up in the year 2005. Reverend Hesburgh, you can see that we have a recorder here today, and you give us permission to record this interview.
Absolutely.
I'd like to start first with a brief overview of your personal and educational background.
Okay. Be modest now.
Okay. Where were you born and educated?
I was born in Syracuse, New York on May the 25th, 1917. As an aside, it's 4 days before Jack Kennedy was born. He was born the 29th. I was educated for 12 years at Most Holy Rosary High School, taught by the nuns from Scranton, Pennsylvania, the IHMs they're called, Immaculate Heart of Mary. I graduated in June of 34 from high school and came here to begin college education in September of 1934. After my first year, I joined the order, I might add, but just as a postulant, not having vows or anything. And I lived in a place called Holy Cross Seminary here at the university on campus. I finished my first year here, and then the following August, I went to what's called a novitiate, which is a year like Marine boot camp training, only worse. You could only talk 2 hours a day, and I'm a great gasser, so that was. And I generally had to do something during the meal, like serve, wait on tables, or wash dishes, so I wound up having to eat later, and I lost half my talking time, which was 2 hours a day, hour after dinner and hour after supper. We took an old abandoned farm, 600 acres, and brought it back to life and put in corn and wheat and all the usual Indiana crops. And that was real hard manual labor, up at 5 every morning and going all day long. And a lot of praying and a lot of spiritual conferences, and I read about 100 books, I think, that year. Then the following, the beginning of that, I should say, was 1935. In August 15th, I received the habit after an 8-day retreat. The following August the 16th, getting the habit was the 15th, 16th August, the year following, having completed a whole year there, I took my first vows for 3 years, vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Then I went back to Notre Dame in September and began the second year of college, which I completed the following June. At that point, I got every year you get a sheet of paper when you belong to an order, and they say what you're going to do the next year. And my sheet was very simple, 4 words, to study in Rome. So I asked them, what's that all about? And they said, well, you're going to go to the Gregorian University in Rome, get a doctorate in philosophy and theology. Well, you know, I was then about 21 years old, or wasn't that, I was still 20 years old, and the thought of being gone for 8 years, I still hadn't, at that point, hadn't seen my family in 2 years. They were tougher in those days than they are today. So I went back to Syracuse, New York, and saw my mother and dad and my three sisters and a brother, who was 16 years younger than I was. He was just a kid at that point. And I saw them for a couple of weeks, and on the 25th of September, 1937, I got aboard the U.S. Champlain. Actually, it was a French Compagnie Générale de Transportation. And I got aboard that French line ship and sailed to Le Havre, after a brief stop at Plymouth, England. In Le Havre, we went into Paris to see the city. We went down to Le Mans, about a three-hour drive from Paris at that time. That's where the order began and where Father Sorin left from. He was one of the first members of the order to come here and found Notre Dame. And on November, the end of November 1942, so the it was nice going back to where it all began. Then we went on to Rome from Paris on the train. And I spent the next 3 years in Rome till the Blitzkrieg began. During that 3 years, I finished my degree in philosophy and started my first year of theology, which I completed. But at the end of May 1940, the American consul came into our class of 700 youngsters. We were taught 4 hours a day at the university, all lecture, all in Latin. You can imagine that. All the textbooks were in Latin. And we had to talk Latin to and from the university to get the facility of speaking it because our exams were oral in Latin. It's a totally different system, but I did a lot of work and we had plenty of time to work. And I noticed being in the seminary here in the States, a bell was always ringing for choir practice or play football or do something. Whereas over there, you had big gobs of 3-4 hours in your room just studying. And since in the house we had to speak French, and on the street Italian, and the university Latin, and I had a Mexican friend who was not anxious to learn Italian. He always spoke to me in Spanish. So by the end of the year, I understood almost perfectly Spanish, but I didn't try to speak it. I did started later, but then I didn't want to mix up the Italian. They're very close together. Well, fast forward, I went back to Washington, 3 years more of theology, and then got ordained in June the 24th, 1943, which is about 57 years ago, I think. I'll be 58 next June, if my arithmetic is right, which it probably isn't. But in any event...
It is.
That's right.
Yeah. In any event, I, after getting my doctor's degree in 45, I was asked to come back. I was trying to get in the Navy as a chaplain. They said, no, I'll come back and start teaching. We got 5,000 Navy right here at Notre Dame, which was true. So I came back in July the 3rd, 1945. And for the next several years, till 1947, I taught 6 classes, believe it or not. I became head of the department in 3 years, in 48. I was writing a book for the course because there were no books on teaching theology to college students. And I was both a rector and then what they called a prefect, that's a good French word, in one of the halls, which meant I was living with the students and had about 80 kids on my floor. And they were all returned veterans, so they were busy years. They had a lot of problems. But they did very well, the best group of students we ever had, I think. At 1949, Father John Cavanaugh, a good Michigander, a good friend of John Hanna's, made me executive vice president, which meant I said, what does that mean? He said, you're vice president of the other 4 vice presidents. And on top of that, you're chairman of the faculty board and control of athletics, so that'll be a big responsibility. And I did that job for 3 years, and in 1952 was named president. And normally in those days, it was a 6-year appointment, because you were also superior of all the religious on campus. There were about 100 priests and brothers. And of course, with that, and canon law doesn't want people to have all that power for longer times than 6 years, so... Since the canon law came in 1918, every president had been here for 6 years. Following the 6-year stint, which I played like a 100-yard dash because making changes in the university is like moving a cemetery. It's pretty complicated. And finally, I came to 1958, and I thought, I'd go back to teaching, which I loved, and living with the students in the halls. In the residence halls. And they said, we changed the rule, you're no longer a religious superior, and there's no limitation in canon law on being president, so you keep going. And I went around that track 6 times as a result of that. I had literally, if you want an easy statement of my life, I had 35 years studying and teaching, and then 35 years as president. And so when I got off, I was 70 years old. And I've been retired now about 14 years. I think that's more than you asked for, but...
No, certainly not. When people think of the relationship between Michigan State and Notre Dame, usually athletic rivalry comes into mind, but I'd like to focus first on your relationship with John Hanna on the U.S. Civil Rights Commission.
Good.
And would you tell us something about how you became involved in that? And
yeah, I got a call from General Eisenhower, now President Eisenhower's assistant, saying the President would like to appoint you to the Civil Rights Commission. Would you accept? And I said, sure. I haven't yet learned how to say no to the President. He had appointed me 2 years earlier to the National Science Foundation Board. Anyway, he called back and he said, oh, I forgot to tell you, there's going to be 6 members, 3 Republicans and 3 Democrats. Are you a Republican or a Democrat? Because you've already appointed 4 or 5 members. And I said, I'm neither. I'm an independent. Fine, he said, we'll make you whatever the opening is. And it went on like that for 15 years. Well, one of the other 2 Northerners was John Hanna, who was my neighbor. And I knew John fairly well because of his relationship to Notre Dame when he called my predecessor, John Kavanaugh, also a Michigander, as I mentioned, from Owosso, and said they were having trouble getting in the Big Ten because Michigan thought they were not in the big time. But if they were playing Notre Dame, they'd obviously be in the big time. And he said, you'd do us a great favor if you let us play every year. And we're willing to play there at your place, and we're willing to take less than half of the cut, 40% instead of 50 or 35 if you'd prefer. John Kavanaugh laughed, and he said, John, we're both Michiganders, and we don't treat each other that way. We'll play you for the next 10 years as soon as we have an opening. And we'll play home and home, and we'll split the whatever we get 50-50. Well, even though he paid us the next 10 years, you whooped us about half of those games, and you got in the Big Ten, which you probably might not have gotten in otherwise, but it was pretty hard to say you weren't big time when you're playing Notre Dame. So in any event, that's how I initially knew John. On the commission, John was kind of laid back, but he was very, very effective, and he was very committed to achieving civil rights opportunity. Mainly we were focused on blacks in this country. I can shorten it up a bit by saying blacks because I know there's an African-American appellation, but I find this one easier. We had almost nothing to start with. We were sworn in at the White House on the 2nd of December, of January, 1958. We, 6 of us, the 3 Southerners were 2 former governors from Florida and from Virginia, and the head of the law school at Southern Methodist, Dean Story. The Northerners were John Hanna and myself, and the only black man in government at that time at any level was the Undersecretary of Labor, who was a lawyer. They were all lawyers except John Hanna and myself. But anyway, this gentleman, I'm reaching for his name and not getting it, but he's on the record. I can find it in 2 minutes if you need it. John was firmly in control. We had almost no money to work with, about $1 million out of the President's Emergency Fund. And we were only on the job, presumably, for 2 years from the time the law was passed in September of 57. So already we had lost about a half a year almost. So we started out and had our first hearing down on voting down in Montgomery, Alabama, and that was a long, involved story. But John proved himself, first of all, to be totally in control of the task we had before us and how we had to do it. Fair but very firm with all the people that testified. And we eventually came to a point of subpoena, in other words, telling our people they had to testify whether they wanted to or not, because that had the advantage of putting them under government protection from that time on, because they were testifying in an official government hearing under government control. And if anybody touched them, the FBI was after them right away. So I made that very clear at the beginning of every meeting. But John was very good with the witnesses. He was very good with the people in opposition, which were just about anybody of any power, and all white, of course, in the South. What we were up against, we soon found out, was rather disturbing. One, there were over 6 million blacks who were not allowed to vote in the South. There was not a single black kid in a school that had whites in it, as students or teachers. And from Mason-Dixon line south, 13 states of the Confederacy, plus most of the border states, went the same route. They spent 1/7 on the black education that was spent on white education. And because blacks were not getting educated, they had a hard time getting jobs and having money, and therefore they couldn't buy houses. And besides, their place they could live was restricted. And they couldn't, and we knew that 6 million of them couldn't even register to vote, which is our main role as we started out. But as time went on, John expanded our role, legitimately, because we were interested in human rights generally, so that we covered really the area of voting, education, housing, employment, administration of justice. There wasn't a single black in the justice system throughout the South. No cops, no state police, no jurors, no judges, no jailkeepers, no sheriffs, nothing. Every time a black got in trouble, which is easy to do if you were black, he faced white justice, which was always, just about always, prejudiced against him. And there had been a whole series of lynchings, of course, that where some white woman alleged that a black guy said a dirty word to her, and he's suddenly hanging from his neck without a trial, without anything. Anyway, and to get back on track here, when we got to Alabama, or before we went even, we wrote the hotels down there saying we were coming to town and could we have reservations for 12 people. We had six commissioners and six assistants. Each one of us had a legal assistant. And the interesting point here was that one of our commissioners was black and two of these lawyers worked for the commission were black. The result of that was that since we asked to get in a hotel, they wrote back and said, we can't possibly take a mixed group in the hotel. The white people can come, but the others will have to go to the black hotel out in the edge of town. So John said, not to worry, we'll go to the federal establishment there. You know, you've got Montgomery Air University, and we all, both he and I, had ROTC units from there. They were operated out of there. We knew the general in charge. So John just wrote a letter to the general saying we were a mixed group at a federal commission with staff people, and we wanted to come there and stay. And John was very calm about it. And we got word back from a major who was the PR guy at Montgomery University saying that they couldn't possibly put a mixed group in the BOQ because nobody would understand that. This was after the armed forces had presumably been integrated by Truman long before, about 10 years before. Well, John was fairly calm. He just called up the Secretary of the Air Force and said, you better override that guy down there. He must not have read the law. The guy came back and said, I can't disturb my place by countermanding the commanding officer, the general. Well, John still was fairly cool, so he called up Secretary of Defense, was a good friend of his and mine, had been the president of General Motors, Charlie
Wilson.
Yeah. And old Charlie came back and said, I'm sorry, guys, but I can't overturn the Secretary of the Air Force. And John said, this is exactly why he's Secretary of Defense, so he can't overturn the fellow who isn't upholding the law. Then John got angry, which he could do after a long period of patience. And he called up the president point blank, and he said, Mr. President, you gave us a terrible job, and we can't very well do it if we don't go out in the boondocks and have these hearings with people that are being treated unjustly. To get all this on record, we hope to turn out 100 books from all parts of the country of these records of these hearings. But how are we going to do it when the first place we're going, we even get turned away from the federal establishment and the Army, Navy, and Air Force, I assume, were ordered integrated by President Truman before you. Well, President Eisenhower was a very calm person, but he too got upset about this, and he reverted to his Army English. And he called up that general and kind of indicated he might be a private first class if he didn't put us up right away. Well, we were put up there, but we were not very welcome, and no one wanted to see us. That was the first problem we had, just getting a place to lay our head during the hearing, which was going to last 3 or 4 days. Then we had a problem. According to Alabama law, they have to keep the voting record for 2 years. And even those that apply to vote, who are trying to register. And he, as the little local judge, had the job of keeping the voting records for the last 2 years from Montgomery. And we just wrote and said we'd like to examine these records, because they had to put on the back if they were turned down, why they were turned down. And he just said, I'll burn them before I'll give them to you. And then we went to the federal judge there, Johnson. This begins to sound like the current election. At the federal judge, and he called up the judge who refused, and he said, we were together in law school, and you're my good friend, but this is the law, and by God, you follow it, or I'll put you in jail. So we got the records, and as we started to examine them, one of the reasons why the applicant was turned down for voting was error in spelling, and he spelled spelling S-P-I-L-L-I-N-G and dotted the I.
Oh, no.
So that gives you some sense of what we're up against. Well, you can multiply that all across the South, all across the West. We had hearings in New York and in Chicago and Philadelphia and Boston, you name it, we had hearings, but not all of them that first year and a half that we were in business. We came out with a report, it's sitting right here in behind you on the wall, at the end of the first report. We had a problem getting that report finished because we were going to do it in late July. It was due in September when the law was signed at the White House, given to the President and the Congress. It was a dual report to both the President and the Congress. And John was worried, and I was worried, because if we said something substantial, it was very likely that the Southerners wouldn't go along with us. Ike had, I think, thrown us a fastball, but it turned out to be serendipitous, because in addition to 3 Republicans and 3 Democrats, he put on 3 Northerners and 3 Southerners. In those days, of course, you had the solid South. They were all Democrats, and I was a freelancer, if you will. So we had a hearing coming up in, wasn't Baton Rouge, Shreveport, Louisiana. And in that hearing, we had to look into voting in Louisiana, which was terrible. I won't go into all these details, but John was right on top of it. He was a cool, I was going to say cat, but he was. He was a cool guy, but he was a strong guy. And he showed great strength of character in the way he conducted those meetings and how firm he was with people who were very contentious. And this was not a small thing. We had hearings where they'd call up the hotel and ask for our room numbers. And they'd say, what do you want them for? And they'd say, well, we want to bomb those characters. And so we had a break-up hearing several times because under threat of bombing in the room, get the FBI to sniff it out. Well, just parenthetically, something that impressed me about John. He had, I think, 3 boys and a girl, and this was during the Vietnam War, part of the 10 years we spent together, and every one of his kids went in the service, whereas everybody else I knew was avoiding that by enrolling in college. They were enrolled, but they still went in the service with the ROTC, most of them, and some of them became officers, and I think they all went to Vietnam. That was a side of his character that was interesting to see. We went on through that first year and a half, and I say had the final hearing in Shreveport, but when I got there about 5 in the morning, I had been fishing up in Canada, and I had to fly down, had a big mess up in the lines. But I finally got there about 5 in the morning, and as I went into the BOQ, again, we're staying with the Air Force at the SAC base in Shreveport. Not much sleep. Those planes were taken off, loaded with atomic bombs about every 15 minutes, taken off and landing, B-52s. So I got there, and these guys are getting up, but they hadn't had much sleep. They're all in a foul mood. And the weather was, you're soaking wet 5 minutes after you get out of the air-conditioned plane. And this marshal comes up and said, "You Hesburgh?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I got something for you." And he hands me, he says, "That's a restraining order from the local federal judge restraining you guys from having a hearing here." Well, he had the power to do it. And we had decided earlier we were going to stay on in Shreveport for 3 days after the hearing, which would be 3 days, and write our report. What are we going to do now at the SAC Air Base with nobody getting any sleep and the weather being just horrendous? So the first thing we did, we got in touch with the federal government, of course, the Department of Justice, and we sued the federal judge for doing this, and that case immediately went to a 3-federal judge panel, and then it was remanded from there to the Supreme Court. And by October, we had an order back from the Supreme Court, rather a record time from July to October, saying that the judge was completely wrong in restraining us, that we had every right to represent the federal government in pursuit of human rights. It was such a clear judgment from every report we put out after that, we ran it on the front page just as justification for what we were doing. So I said, "John, I got a great idea. Why don't we, I'll get an airplane from one of our friends over in Kansas, Mr. O'Shaughnessy." He had an old DC-3, a nice DC-3. "And we'll fly up to our fishing camp at Land O'Lakes, Wisconsin, and we can do the report up there. The weather's cool, and we can go fishing while we're doing it." Well, that too was wonderful, because these guys, I called up O'Shaughnessy, and he said, "What do you want the airplane for?" And I told him, he said, "That's a good cause. It'll be over there about 1 o'clock. I said, "Well, stop at the regular airport and get some fuel, because you can't get it here, just jet fuel." And then I said, "I'll clear with the general so you can land here, because civilian airplanes couldn't land at the SAC base." So they got in about 1:30, and we climbed on the plane, the 12 of us, and the other 5 commissioners who had been up all night, I'd been on an airplane all, they went right to sleep in these comfy chairs aboard this converted DC-3. And I got in the back and sitting on the floor with the staff people, and we whacked out the guts of this report. They've been working on it for a long time, but we had to come down with conclusions, recommendations, and that was the heart of the report. And we had 12 of them, I think about 3 on voting, about 3 on education, and maybe 3 or 4 on, well, maybe 4 on each of these 3 subjects, the last one, of course, being, I believe, employment. But we had education was the important one, and of course voting was the most important one. That's why the commission was originally set up. And I figured, while these guys are sleeping, we'll make these 12 tough recommendations. We can get them by the 3 Southerners, we're home free, but that was a long shot. Well, anyway, they all went to sleep and it took about 5 hours. It's a slow airplane. And we landed at Atlanta Lakes, went over, and I called ahead and had big steaks ready for them and drink if they wanted it. So we had cocktails and steaks and baked potatoes, and then I said, "You want to go fish?" And turned out they're all fishermen. So we went out, and they caught more fish that night. I think the Lord was doing something with us. They came back 10 o'clock on a high. They'd had a good 4-hour, 5-hour sleep going up there. They had a wonderful meal. They were catching great big bass and pike and muskellunge, and everybody caught fish because I had the best guides we could get to take them out in the right places. So I thought, "Boy, John, let's do it right now when they're in such a good mood." So we got them out on the front porch and screened in, the sun or the moon coming up across the lake, pine-scented air. And I told them, I said, "While you guys were sleeping, the staff and I put together these final recommendations, and I think we got to all vote on them, John." And he said, "Okay, I'll chair it." So we discussed each one, and believe it or not, the first 11 passed unanimously, 6-0, which was incredible because it was pretty strong on it, on education. It was very strong on voting. You try to keep someone from being able to be registered to vote, and you go to jail, and no fiddle-dee-dee about it. And education we were fairly strong on. So we got to the last one, and the former governor of Virginia said, "Father Ted, would you hate me if I vote against this?" And And John said, Father Ted doesn't hate anybody. And I said, that's right. And I'm about to start. Just vote your conscience. He said, that won't do. I know what's right and wrong here. I'm just can't go home if I vote for putting black and white kids together in the same classroom. And I said, well, that's what it's about. But I said, vote your conscience, John. Don't. He said, I can't vote my conscience. I got to vote the wrong way, and I know that, and you know that. So anyway, he voted against it. So we arrived at the White House a month later in September, and with this report, and Ike apparently had read those recommendations carefully, and he said, my God, you know, they put three Republicans and three Democrats, figuring they wouldn't agree on anything. And then I put on three Northerners and three Southerners, and you guys are 100% 6-0 for 11 of the 12 recommendations. Now, there might have been 10. I don't remember the exact number. It was about that number. And these are pretty strong medicine. And you're recommending this to the Congress, which sets you up to do that. And he was so impressed with it, he said, how can you explain that? You know, you guys are Southern governors, two of you, Florida and Virginia. And you're a Southern Methodist law school. Well, they said, we listened to a lot of